The issue I want to address is the recovery from the flood. This is a less clear period of time in Scripture, but if one thinks about the concept of a flood covering the entire earth, and then comparing that with the present, there probably was, or had to have been, some sort of period of recovery between the flood and the present. The scripture tells us a little bit about that. First of all, as I've said in the lecture earlier yesterday, the time between the flood and Abraham amounts to about 3.5 centuries. This would suggest the flood is about 4,500 years ago, 4,500 years ago, and the recovery of the flood was probably complete at least by the time of Abraham, so that, at least by the time he's entering Canaan, or most of the recovery, as I'm about to say, there's some that's still going on. This suggests that the majority of the recovery had occurred within a few centuries of the flood. Also, it may not be significant, but it's interesting that in the book of Job, you have concentrated in that book more total references, not individual, but total references to ice, snow, frost, cold, and even a frozen ocean, than any other book in the Bible. But it also is the oldest book in the Bible. I suspect that if Job corresponds to someone in a genealogy of Scripture, which I think is likely, then he is almost certainly the Jobab of Genesis chapter 10, which puts him only a few generations after the flood. And the events in the book of Job would precede Abraham and be just a couple centuries into that recovery from the flood. And if those references to ice, snow, frost, and cold being large in number is significant, and especially a reference to a frozen ocean, then perhaps we're talking about in the days of Job some sort of a glacial phenomenon, perhaps an ice age. Also, at least two references refer to a different climate in the land of Canaan. We have, first of all, the parting of Abraham and Lot. They went up to a high point, and Abraham says, you can have whatever you want. Go whichever direction you wish. And Lot looks down on the plain of the Jordan and chooses that. And there's a parenthetical note in the Hebrew there. It says, the plain of Jordan was well watered in those days, as if it wasn't by the time that passage was written in the time of Moses. And of course, we know of that area now as the Dead Sea. It is definitely not well watered. It is now a complete desert. And then later, when the people of Israel are approaching the land of Canaan, even 40 years before the beginning of their wandering, the land of Canaan is referred to as a land that flows with milk and honey. And references to the productivity of the land, again, don't correspond to the productivity in the present. The land appears to be more well-watered in those days than it is in the present. And that suggests, but perhaps not as well-watered as it was in the days of Lot. So there seems to be a bit of evidence that things are drying off. Perhaps I can share with you a very profound statement. I believe the wettest period in Earth history was the flood. How about that? And that the earth has been drying off ever since. And in fact, that drying off has taken centuries. And as I'm about to argue, I think that the recovery from the flood is still occurring in the present. See, geologic activity on this planet is dependent on how fast rocks can move and that sort of thing. And the current state of the earth is such that if we have a rock out of place, let's say there's a rock that's too high, sitting too high, or rock that is too low, think of a glacier in water, an ice cube in water. You can push it down let it go, and it bobs up. Or if you pull it up, let it go, it bobs down. The Earth's rocks are like that. If you took a humongous mountain and set it on the ground and waited, it would bob down until the mass of the Earth it's displacing equals the mass of the mountain. So if, in fact, the mountain you put there is less dense than the material it's sitting on, it will sink beneath the surface. If it is lighter than the material it's sitting on, it will stay, at least a portion of it, will stay above the surface. But because the Earth is so viscous, it's going to take an estimated 30,000 years to accomplish that. So don't wait around or hold your breath. But since the flood is only 4,500 years ago, if the flood put anything out of place, if it put too much stuff in one place, buried, piled up a bunch of sediment in one place, eroded sediment away from another place, created mountains in one place, eroded mountains off in another, and then it's going to take 30,000 years for the Earth to recover, we're still recovering. And so we're inclined to think, as creationists, that all the mountains, volcanoes, all the Earth's volcanoes, all the Earth's earthquakes, all geologic activity of the present is leftover remnant activity from the flood. Geologically speaking, we're still in the flood. We're still feeling the effects of the flood. Now, the recovery would have been very rapid at first. You can watch this as you watch an ice cube that bobs back to its isostatic equilibrium position. It moves very quickly at first and bobs slower as time goes on. And that's the way it would work geologically. The recovery would be very rapid following the flood, and it's still occurring today, but much more slowly. So we have these observations from the Bible from which we might infer that flood recovery began not too long ago, geologically speaking, only a few thousand years ago, and that recovery was rapid over the course of centuries, again, geologically speaking, rapid, not with respect to our individual lifetimes, but with respect to the way rocks generally behave, rather rapidly. It suggests that there was perhaps a recent glaciation, and as a matter of fact, catastrophic plate tectonics modeling leads to a glacial event following the flood, which is pretty cool. Get to that in a bit. And according to catastrophic plate tectonics, recovery would have taken centuries. Seems to fit the biblical account. So first of all, evidence, and again, now we've left the absolute data of Scripture, the certain data of Scripture, and then we've built from that a theory, and from that theory we've made predictions, and so we're not getting this directly out of the Bible. But we can take this theory we've generated based upon the truth of Scripture and make some predictions. One of them is that the recovery from the flood was very recent, in only thousands of years ago. Another part of our theory is that when God chose the organisms to go onto the ark, the land animals, for example, to go onto the ark, it said in the biblical account he took pairs of each kind of animal. And it refers to kinds of animals. It doesn't say species, although species is the Latin translation of the Hebrew word mean, and so in the Vulgate it really does say species. But it doesn't necessarily refer to species. We have reason to believe from creation biology that in fact the created kind is a larger group than species. It's in fact larger probably than genera, the genus that species put in, genera are put in families. We think on the average the created kind is about the level of the family, that classification level, sometimes a little bit lower, perhaps the genus, sometimes a little bit higher at the superfamily level. Examples of families would be the dog family, the canids. That would be all the foxes, coyotes, the wolves, and of course the dogs. The felids, that would be all the cats, the big cats and the little cats, and lions and tigers, and all of that would be one family and probably a single created kind, and so on. So we're talking about groups of organisms, not species, but larger groups of organisms, where God chose only two or sevens of each of those and took them onto the ark. But those families in the present have hundreds of species, scores or hundreds, in some cases thousands of species. That would suggest that between the flood and the present, within created kinds, there has been the origin of a number of new species. Maybe they're not new, and maybe they're restoring species that existed before the flood, but when you've got 120 species of in the cattle family, for example, in the bovid family, there would have been 120 species come into being after the flood. I believe there's evidence that that happened, and it's in what we call interspecific hybrids. When we take two different species and cross them, they sometimes, or attempt to cross them, sometimes they produce viable offspring, and these are interspecific hybrids. Now, if two species can produce viable offspring, it suggests that they're, one, they're not very different, must be similar enough to be able to produce hybrids. Two, maybe it even argues that they came from the same common ancestor. And I would suggest not too long ago, because it's pretty easy to lose the ability to interbreed. I mean, we have that in human couples that fail to be able to produce offspring. It's very easy to lose the ability to produce viable offspring. So the fact that two different species could do this suggests they probably were descended from a common ancestor and not very long ago. So an example here is in the camel family. There are five species of camels in the world, two species in the Asian continent, the dromedary single humped camel, and the Bactrian double-humped camel. And there are three species in the New World in South America, the guanacos, the vicuñas, and the llamas. And interspecific hybrids are known. We've crossed the Bactrian and dromedary camels to produce a larger single-humped camel. We've produced alpacas are interspecific hybrids between vicuñas and llamas. We've crossed all of these combinations, and in 1998, we crossed a camel with a llama to produce a Kama. And this is Rama the Kama, born in 1998. Since then, a number of other Kamas have been generated in this fashion. And it suggests that all five species of the camels are descended from a single common ancestor, probably two camels that came off the ark, probably looking more like llamas than traditional camels, and that the diversification has occurred very recently since then. What's even more stunning about this is that you've got camels in Asia and the llamas in South America. If conventional dating is right, and we're talking about millions of years, the last time North America or South America was in any way connected with Asia and thus could explain a common ancestor was 50 million years ago. There is no possible way that organisms separated for 50 million years and changing independently of each other should still be able to interbreed. So the fact that there's a very recent flood and diversification within the created kinds actually explains interspecific hybrids, and the conventional explanation cannot. And it isn't as true of the camel family. In fact, interspecific hybrids is a dominant characteristic of life, even though that's not what you'll read or hear in university. I went to the university and majored in biology, and aside from one class, which the name of the class was What is a Species, we never even discussed the possibility that interspecific hybrids existed. Most people would refer to a horse and a donkey creating a mule and that mule being infertile, as being proof that species are separate and can't interbreed. But in fact, you cross the horse and the donkey the other way, and you get a hinny, which is always fertile, and 1 in 1,000 mules are fertile, and almost every other interspecific hybrid is, in fact, fertile. All of the camel hybrids are fertile. So the fact is that all the families, on the average, 85% of the species within a family can interbreed successfully and produce interspecific hybrids, suggesting that all families have diversified in it very recently, and that's explained by the recent recovery from a flood. In addition, we have evidence of rebounding mountains. I already referred to the fact that that isostatic rebound, you push that ice cube down and let it go and it rebounds upwards. Well, during the flood, mountains were formed and then the tops of the mountains were shaved off in the erosive events that followed, leaving deep roots of the mountains. It's kind of like putting the ice cube down deep. Now the mountains are rebounding in response to it. And again, as I said, that should occur completely. It should be completely done in 30,000 years or so. We have some very old mountains in the world, according to conventional dating. The Appalachians, where I live, same mountains as you all have here, date about 300 million years ago. They should not be rebounding. There is a place near where I live, about 2-hour drive over the mountains from me, Cleveland, Tennessee, which is the geologically most active region east of the Rockies in North America. There are 3 to 4 earthquakes a day in Cleveland, Tennessee. Most of them people don't notice. They're only picked up by seismometers. But conventional geologists are completely mystified. Why are there earthquakes in Cleveland, Tennessee? The mountains should be dead in the sense of they've already rebounded. They shouldn't be rebounding upward, but the evidence is they are. They're rebounding in the present, old mountains. That's explained if, in fact, they're formed only 4,500 years ago, and they would still be rebounding. There's Yellowstone National Park in the States. South of there is the Tetons. The Teton Mountains that are seen, beautiful pictures above Jackson Hole, those mountains are moving at 1.5 inches a year upward with respect to the valley. And this activity is all over the world. K2 and Everest are moving at feet per year upwards and downwards in rebound. And that's not explainable in conventional wisdom. Another phenomenon, genetic throwbacks. These would be organisms that are born every once in a while that have characteristics of their ancestors. Every once in a while, a horse, for example, is born with 3 toes on front and back. Current horses are standing on toes, that which looks like, to most of us, probably an elbow and a knee on the legs of horses, are actually not that. They're the wrist and the ankle bones, ankle joints of the horses. The actual knee and elbow are up at the body level. And so everything from that looks like a knee elbow down to the ground is a single toe. And that single toe came from horses that had as many as 5 toes that went all the way to the ground. But every once in a while, a horse is born that has 3 of those toes. And that's evidence that it actually came from a horse with 3 toes going down to the ground. And we have fossils of such things. The issue here is that if a horse is born able to have 3 toes, that means the information for building 3 toes is still viable inside all horses, even though it doesn't necessarily show up in all horses. And the problem for evolution with invisible information that's not displayed, is that mutations can take it out and destroy it, and natural selection can't preserve it. So if you've got hidden information gets destroyed by mutations. The likelihood of a mutation is basically one in a million at each given position on the each nucleotide of the DNA. So after a million generations, any hidden information should be completely, completely gone. But these horses in the fossil record, if you're going to accept their dating for it, are 50 million years old. So modern horses are descendant from horses with three toes that lived 50 million years ago. The information has been hidden for 50 million years. It can't be. That information is still viable because occasionally we have a three-toed horse. And so that suggests that modern horses are descendant from three-toed horses much more recently, consistent with the idea of being after the flood only 4,500 years ago. Similar to genetic throwbacks are vestiges or vestigial organs. These would be not the occasional individual born with the characteristics of an ancestor, but an entire population that has the characteristic of an ancestor in reduced, less form. And here, again, the horse, on either side of the single digit of the horse, the single finger or toe of a horse, are two little stubs, splints, that are actually the tiny little leg bones from three-toed horses. It's those bones that extend down to the ground in the occasional genetic throwback. So every horse in the present has a vestigial evidence of those extra digits. Again, when you have, if you have something that isn't used or is used in only a minor way, mutation should destroy it. And the fact that we still have vestigial organs are used as evidence of evolution. But it's a double-edged sword, because it is evidence that the modern organisms are descendant from different organisms, but it suggests that it must be very recently, only thousands of years, not millions of years. Also, we have evidence that that there was a glaciation on this planet. Catastrophic plate tectonics actually generates that as an expectation. What it comes down to, oversimplified, is that plate tectonics, catastrophic plate tectonics, heats up the oceans during the flood. All the ocean floors, which before the flood were cold, are replaced in the course of the flood with lava. The lava cools off by the ocean water. That heats up the ocean water. We estimate that it would heat up the ocean water about 20 degrees centigrade. The current picture, current average temperature of the ocean is about 5 degrees centigrade, so that would heat up the oceans to, just after the flood, to 25 degrees centigrade, or room temperature, throughout. That's a lot of heat being stored in the oceans. Then following the flood, the oceans would cool by evaporation and precipitation onto the continents. Huge rainfall rates following the flood. We think somewhere in the order of two orders of magnitude more rainfall immediately after the flood than is found today. You'd have basically tropical conditions across the entire planet with high rainfall rates across the entire planet. And then it would, that precipitation would gradually cool the oceans. We have evidence of this. When we actually model this, it happens fast and only fast. This is one thing that's kind of interesting. The secular scientists developed models to create an ice age. They were curious about how the ice age came to be, so we created computer models to figure it out. Every computer model that has been successful in producing an ice age starts with a warm ocean. You've got to have a warm ocean. The problem with the secular world is they have no mechanism to heat up the ocean to create the conditions necessary for glacial ice age. Catastrophic plate tectonics heats up the oceans for that. And the second problem is that all of their models accomplishes this in only a few centuries. It does not take thousands of years. It does not take million years. It, in fact, only takes centuries to build up the ice and then melts very rapidly in the matter of decades. So modeling rates so far have only generated an ice advance or glacial ice age very fast on the time scales that the Bible is talking about. Furthermore, we have curious areas near where I lived in Illinois, grew up in Illinois. There is a place called a Driftless Area. All of Illinois, except for the Driftless Area, is covered with drift. Is the material left by the glaciers as they came down from the north, carrying rocks and soil and all of that sort of thing. And then they melted going back. They drifted all of that material over the landscape. But there's a portion of Illinois that has no drift, as if there were no glaciers there. There's glaciers to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west, but there's a section there with no glaciers at all. The only explanation people know for that is that the glaciers were either not as thick as the conventional wisdom would suggest, or they went so quickly, they moved so quickly, that they didn't span out and cover the entire region they transgressed. And so actually, a rapid ice age advancing in the matter of a few decades after it builds up to its maximum height explains the driftless areas, and the conventional ice age has no explanation for the driftless areas. Also, there are areas with almost no glacial rebound. When the glaciers moved across an area, they were so thick that that's like putting a huge weight on that area, and it bowed the land down. The longer the ice stayed there, the more it bows the land down. The area where the ice built up in North America was centered on Hudson Bay, went out from there to what's now Greenland and so on. That area was covered with glaciers for a very long time and bowed down quite a bit. Then at the point that it collapsed, there was a point where it was no longer accumulating, but it was so thick that it flowed out under its own weight, if you wish, and spread to the south and covered the northern part of the what's now the United States. So if you look at the United States and you see the Missouri River coming into the Mississippi and then the Ohio River coming into the Mississippi, the lower boundaries of those two rivers are where the glaciers went to. Those rivers were formed by the melting glacier water at the end of the glaciers. But everything from that point up to the location in Canada where it built up was occupied by ice in our model only momentarily, only a matter of perhaps a decade or two. And as a result, it didn't have enough time to push the land down. As a consequence, the rebounding in these areas, there hasn't been much glacial rebound. And this is shown in various ways, interestingly enough, by the position of cemeteries. People put cemeteries on glacial moraines, on places where there's more sand, because you can dig in the sand easier than the frozen soil. So cemeteries mark the positions of the glaciers as they retreated in Indiana and Illinois. And those glaciers, those cemeteries, show very little to no rebound. They are not higher than they would be if rebound had occurred. And so the lack of distal rebound suggests that the glaciers were on those areas for only decades, not thousands of years, such as conventional wisdom would suggest. We also have increasing evidence, this has not been accepted in the secular world until the last few decades, but we now realize that as the glaciers melted, they didn't melt slowly. They melted catastrophically. They melted very quickly. And in fact, this is now causing considerable concern on the melting of the glaciers in Greenland and Antarctica. What seems to have occurred following the glacial melt, or as the glaciers melted, is they melted underneath the glaciers into huge lakes of water and then broke out from underneath the glacier, ripping apart the glacier above it and taking out the glacier in the matter of minutes and creating huge canyons, the Mississippi Palisades, the Illinois River Canyon, the Wisconsin Dales, All of these things are canyons made in the process of only weeks of time at most because of rapid glacial outwash. We're now realizing that underneath Antarctica are huge lakes of water accumulating as the glaciers are melting underneath Antarctica. And we're afraid that the same thing that occurred in North America is going to happen there. It would take a very long time to melt Antarctica from the top down. But if, in fact, underneath Antarctica, you built up ice and then it broke out from underneath, it'd take all of the ice of Antarctica out in the matter of minutes. That would raise the ocean level around the world tens of meters in virtually instantaneously, flooding a billion people out of their. This is a concern that conventional geologists are now considering, because the evidence is that's what happened when the past glaciers melted. We also have a problem of how to accumulate ice. In the present world, there is no snow falling on the North Pole. It's too cold. There's no place, in fact, all of the glaciers, there's no snow falling in Greenland. It is not accumulating. It's miles deep on Greenland and Antarctica, but there's no snow falling on the source. How do you get the glaciers to accumulate? In the modern world, they can't accumulate that way. It's only when they're forced with a very warm ocean and you force the precipitation over these centers of accumulation that you can explain the ice. Again, there's no explanation for the warming of the oceans. We have evidence that the oceans did in fact cool. Here is a graph of the inferred ocean temperature based on the chemistry of little foraminifera, which are tiny little critters that single-celled organisms in the ocean. We can actually infer past temperature of the ocean by the chemistry of the little critters that are buried in the bottom of the ocean. And it's clearly a drop in temperature of, interestingly enough, about 20 degrees centigrade that corresponds to the predictions of CPT. Here's a problem for the conventional world, though. Whereas on the bottom of this graph, I have, you know, decades or centuries following the flood, the conventional wisdom is that this cooling occurred over 50 million years of time. There is no explanation for this secular worldwide decrease in temperature of the ocean for 50 million years. No explanation whatsoever. Catastrophic plate tectonics and the production of the glaciers explains the data, and conventional world cannot. It also explains what global warming really is and what true global warming is. It is not a human-engineered phenomenon. Humans have impacted it in a minor way in more recent years. But in fact, the Earth is still recovering from the flood. Here's what apparently happened. After the flood, we had a warm ocean. The ocean cooled by precipitating water over the continents. When it cooled sufficiently in certain areas, that precipitation fell as ice and it as snow and accumulated as ice, and accumulated so rapidly as to produce miles of ice in two locations in particular on the planet, centered on the Hudson Bay on one side of the planet and centered on Antarctica on the other, probably, parenthetically, by a hypercane, by a single storm in each case, sitting for centuries over one location, a storm that is the size of a continent, similar to the storm we have been observing on Jupiter. The great red spot on Jupiter is a hurricane. It's a hurricane the size of the Earth that has been going on for over 300 years in the atmosphere of Jupiter. That is a hypercane. It's a big hurricane. We think that two hypercanes set up themselves after the flood, one over Antarctica and one over the Hudson Bay, and the extent of it would have been over all of North America in one direction and over all of Europe in the other. for example. We'd all be in the midst of a hurricane here if we were at that time. And what it was doing is taking up all the heat from the ocean underneath it, sucking it up, and then dropping it as precipitation. At the end of that, when it got so cool that the two hypercanes broke up, then the ice flowed out and began melting rapidly. The ice, of course, is freshwater ice. And so it melts as fresh water, which flows out over the oceans. It flowed out over the Arctic Ocean and froze. Here's the problem, it's fresh water, so it could actually freeze under those circumstances. Once it froze over the Arctic Ocean, it now reflected sunlight into space where it was, previous to that, the water was absorbing sunlight. Now the albedo, or the reflectivity of the Earth, increased markedly, and the sunlight was reflected into space that froze, basically, the melting of the glaciers. The glaciers stopped melting at that point, leaving us with the glacial caps in Greenland and Antarctica. Ever since then, the Earth has been gradually melting that ice because the normal condition of this planet is no ice. That's the normal condition. That was the pre-flood condition. That was the condition at the end of the flood. That is the condition to which it is moving. And it's been thinning the ice over the Arctic Ocean. And it'll eventually melt that ice. And then that will accelerate the melting of the ice worldwide. And we should expect a completion of the melting event. And that's true global warming. Other evidences, we have centuries of flood recovery in terms of volcanoes. The biggest volcanoes, I've already referred to enormous thousands, actually kilometers of volcanic ash during the flood. Following the flood, we don't have that much, but we have a lot. The blocks here represent relative volumes of ash produced by 5 volcanic eruptions. There's a little red one way off to the right there, you can barely see. That represents 1 cubic kilometer of ash that was generated by the eruption of Mount St. Helens on May 18, 1980. The next one is Krakatoa. I'm sorry, no, that's still too small to see. The next one is Crater Lake. Represented in the yellow on the map up above. It produced, I think it was something like 75 cubic kilometers of ash when it blew up, leaving a crater on the top of a mountain that's filled with water and a beautiful place that people call Crater Lake. Previous to that, there was another eruption represented in green, the ash there. 600 cubic kilometers of ash were generated in the Bishop eruption. Previous to that is the light blue, the Lava Creek Tuff, 1,000 cubic kilometers of ash. The Huckleberry Ridge Tuff, which is centered in what is now Yellowstone National Park, 2,500 cubic kilometers of rock pulverized into ash and sent up into the atmosphere. That particular eruption, if it were to occur today, would have a 100% kill. That means killing every animal and plant from the Mississippi River west to the west coast of North America. From south from Mexico all the way up several hundred kilometers into Canada. It's an extraordinary eruption. Now, these eruptions are older and older and older. They're in order of time. The oldest one is the biggest one. And so what we have evidence of is that as we look at volcanoes following the flood, they are not as big as the ones in the flood, but they're a whole lot bigger than anything in the present. And they've been decreasing in intensity ever since. Also, there's a change in volcanic chemistry. I referred to two different types of volcanoes during the flood, and acidic volcanoes and basaltic volcanoes. A third type, rhyolitic volcanoes, only occurred in the first couple centuries following the flood. These are extremely explosive volcanoes. The Huckleberry Ridge Tuff is an example of one of those eruptions. It is so explosive that it never leaves a volcano. It creates a caldera in the ground, and there's nothing left. It blows any sort of everything away over hundreds of kilometers of area. Also, we have evidence of a drying Earth, as again, that I think the wettest period in Earth history is the flood, and it dries off ever since. We have evidence of pluvial lakes all over the world, huge lakes immediately following the flood. We have one diagrammed here, upstream of what is now the Grand Canyon. That particular lake that can actually, its shoreline can be seen quite readily in satellite photos in the present, contain 10 times as much water as all of the Great Lakes of North America now contain. And this accumulated, this is one of thousands of humongous pluvial lakes that are found evidenced following the flood, caused by the extremely high rainfall of the flood. When those lakes burst through whatever dams were holding them back, and the one that's pictured to the left there broke through a dam known as the Kaibab Upwarp to produce the Grand Canyon. It eroded 800 cubic kilometers of rock out of the Grand Canyon in probably a matter of a few weeks in releasing all of that water. Taking out another 100 plus cubic kilometers of rock to the north and east in the position of those lakes. So it's the release of water from these pluvial lakes that produced most of the canyons of the world. And the canyons of the world typically are underfit geologically, meaning you got a big canyon, you got a little bitty bitty stream running down the middle of the canyon. It's like, what? Did that stream really make that thing? It's literally not possible for a stream of that size to create a canyon of that huge size. And matter of fact, if you study the modern rivers, there are no modern rivers, to my knowledge, that are cutting vertically at all. They're cutting laterally, but at the bottom of those rivers, they're in a canyon that's half full of debris, and they're moving that debris around, and they're not cutting, they're not making a bigger canyon. None of them. They're all underfit rivers. Evidence of a time before that when rivers the size of the canyons actually cut those things. So all of the canyons of the world show evidence of higher rainfall in the past. We also have evidence of, there goes my time. We have evidence of a corresponding to the decrease in rainfall, we have a change of climate from forest to grassland. In North America, we didn't have prairies immediately after the flood. We had forests over all of North America. But we make the transition, and the fossil record shows that transition, from the forest to the grassland. And so we go from horses with four toes that can't run fast and are small and eat leaves of bushes to horses that grow tall, run fast, and eat the grass of grasslands. And that change, that transformation in plants, we change from C3 to C4 photosynthesis. I don't have time to explain this, but this is an extraordinary thing that occurs in 16 different plant families at the same time in North America. It's an impossible thing. Complexity-wise, this is hugely complex, but this C4 photosynthesis appears in 16 different groups at the same time because it's built into those organisms to do that in the by God. Also, hypsodonty appears in most of the mammal families. This is special teeth that can eat grass. You can't eat grass if you got normal teeth like we do, because grass has particles of silicon dioxide, sand in it, that would erode our teeth down and destroy them. You have to have special hypsodont teeth to eat grass. And so multiple groups of organisms develop Hypsodonte out of nowhere, and all at the same time, corresponding with C3 to C4 photosynthesis. We have deserts creating across the world. Deserts, the modern deserts are recent. None of them are old. The Sahara Desert is covering forests and rivers. There's a transition in Egypt from a time when it was well watered. The carving of the Sphinx in sandstone was during a time when Egypt was well watered. And the Sphinx, the pyramids built behind them, behind the Sphinx, from a period when it was not well watered. There's a transition in Egypt from well watered to desert. I believe Joseph is at that transition in history. In short, because I don't have any more time, again, as I've said before, the Bible is a better starting point for understanding Earth history, in this case, the rocks that follow the rocks formed in the flood. They're a better explanation for those rocks, what we call the Cenozoic rocks, than any other theory that humans have ever generated. Thank you.